Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Francine Foss and Lynn Wilson. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology specializing in the treatment of lymphomas. Dr. Wilson is a professor of therapeutic radiology, and he's an expert in the use of radiation to treat lung cancers and cutaneous lymphomas. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This week, Francine and Lynn are joined by Dr. Barry Boyd. Dr. Boyd is director of the Integrative Medicine Program at Greenwich Hospital and an assistant clinical professor at the Yale School of Medicine, and he joins us this evening for a conversation about nutrition and cancer. Here's Francine Foss.
Let's start off by having you tell us a little bit about your role and the whole topic of integrative medicine and what actually it is that you do with nutrition and cancer.
Well, what's happened is this has evolved over the last at least 5 years. I originally helped set up an integrative medicine program at Greenwich Hospital, interestingly in part because I was the only physician who really had training in nutrition. And the dilemma is that for many people, nutrition is alternative medicine. And so I was trying to fill in the gaps for people, and I helped set up a program, but not truly as a as somebody who works a lot in the complementary field, but by virtue of the fact that this is where nutrition has often fallen in terms of patient care. And that led me to spend more and more time working on nutrition. But ultimately, my background was that for the last 25 years in practice, I've been devoted to really developing a program for patients on looking at the role of nutrition in cancer prevention, and as a result, helping them to understand the potential for nutrition in cancer care as the field has evolved. And I've been much more interested in the science behind this. And as a result, what's interesting, in the last 3 years, I've taken over the directorship of the curriculum at Yale in nutrition. So I run the medical school curriculum at the Yale Medical School. So I help them developing and give quite a few of the lectures to the first and second year medical students. And more recently, they've created a position for me as director of cancer nutrition for the Yale Health System in order to help bring more nutrition education, I think, to the patients.
Is there anything, before you started this program, was there any education on nutrition?
Well, you know, it's interesting. When I'll tell you a little story. When I went to medical school, I had an hour of nutrition. preceding my medical school, I had 4 years of graduate school in nutrition, so I immediately saw the enormous disparity between what physicians learn. I always made the joke that I had an hour of nutrition in medical school, and then I went through residency and fellowship in cancer and had no nutrition. It was called the basic nutrition training was the phone number for the dietitian. And I often found that the dietitians, while very good and trained in how to help with diet, were really not trained in research nutrition and weren't familiar with many of the controversies in this field. And so for 20 years, I essentially have been more and more using my background in nutrition to fill in the gaps for patients. So I see myself in many ways as a nutrition educator. And that's sort of what led me to first working with some of the people in the School of Public Health, Susan Maines, Melinda Irwin, and others who have invited me up to give lectures on nutrition and cancer survival related to my interest in the role of insulin, weight, and energy balance, which is really a more central growth, which we can talk about. And from that, recognizing that there was a need to create a nutrition curriculum at Yale and then being invited to do that, which is a full-time job that I do part-time in addition to my full-time oncology practice.
So you obviously have a tremendous amount of experience and expertise, and you've bridged that gap for Yale, the students, the community, Connecticut. But does that gap still exist in other places, other states, other parts of this state, for example?
Oh, I think it does. I think what I've found is I see on a daily basis 2 to 3 patients a day coming to me because they get misinformation or they don't know where to go for valid nutritional advice, and it runs the gamut from what do I do about supplements to what about, you know, an alkaline diet. I have to stop dairy. And I actually have spent an enormous amount of time, and interestingly, in each of these controversial areas and look at the science and what does it tell us and how valid are these, quote, complementary nutrition approaches in order to help people make reasonable and healthy choices and give them a little broader and more science-based understanding. Because, you know, most physicians sort of say, well, that's not my expertise. So I wouldn't say they'll dismiss it, but they don't have time for that. And having developed this, I've found what I've discovered is a gigantic unmet need out there. And it's very hard. There are very few people nationally who do this. And the people that I have worked with and seen in this field very often themselves don't know the science well enough to provide valid information.
Can you comment on the role of nutrition in a broad sense in cancer? Are there certain cancers where nutritional contributions are more important, or do you view that nutrition is important overall for all cancer patients and that there should be a nutritional program as part of the therapeutic approach for these patients?
Well, the answer to all of that is yes. To make it actually a little more comprehensive, what I would say is that we are learning more and more about how nutrition fits into a person's lifestyle, their individual biology, and where nutrition as a component of lifestyle can influence not only tolerance to therapy, but survival. What's really fascinating is the evolution of our understanding about what nutrition is. It used to be that we spent an enormous amount of time on the role of micronutrients. And so that led to millions of dollars in research in what is it about plants that is linked to their relationship in terms of better survival and reduced risk. Now, what's most fascinating just in this field is that in the last 3 to 4 years, we have had the maturation of large cohort studies that show that within a population of adults, the relationship between high versus low fruits and vegetables plays a role in about 2 to 3 or 4% of cancer risk, far less than all of the early case control studies showed, suggesting that maybe we either have missed the timing. And I always say, you know, for parents, make sure your kids eat their fruits and vegetables. If you actually think about it, the anti-carcinogenic effects of these nutrients may play a bigger role in the very earliest stages of cancer. One of the things I educate patients about is that nutrition as part of lifestyle, is a long life part of your life. And in fact, the origins of cancer very often are decades before the onset of the cancer. And many of the things that we associate or assume are related to it as an adult may play a bigger role when you're a child. More importantly, in adulthood, one of the biggest factors linked to outcomes with cancer are things that are promotional factors like hormones. So we know estrogen clearly is a risk factor for breast cancer, for uterine cancer, and the level of estrogen isn't simply whether you take hormone replacement therapy, which raises risk over long term, particularly combined hormones for breast, but your weight. And weight gain over adulthood plays a role in the risk for many cancers, not just breast cancer. But increasingly, we're seeing that the relationship between weight, lifestyle, and one's metabolism can actually change survival, where weight and energy balance, and through it, things like insulin and insulin resistance, seem to play major roles in survival, and how through lifestyle interventions, exercise, and weight control, we can actually target that. And I see this in many ways. We talk about other cancers where we use targeted therapies. And what's fascinating is the evolution of this as a paradigm to understand that lifestyle can actually be a targeted approach for many cancers.
So a lot of patients actually didn't do the right thing when they were younger, and maybe they're overweight and they didn't eat the right things. But they come into your office now, they already have cancer. And
right.
The question is, if I change everything right now, is that going to make anything better for me? Is it going to make an impact what I do right now going forward?
Well, I think that there are interestingly, data that is observational only, for the most part, that suggests that in a few cancers, we can reduce recurrence. For instance, in breast cancer and in colorectal cancer, there's very interesting observational data that increasing levels of physical activity can actually lower recurrence rate by, in some cases, 50%. But again, that's observational. And so there are studies that are using that as part of lifestyle to see if we can truly impact on that. My interest is that while we look at breast and colon cancer as being very sensitive to growth factors like insulin, which I think is actually one of the most important growth factors that is more ubiquitously expressed in tumors, even in hematologic malignancies. We know that weight plays a role in outcome from lymphomas and from leukemias, and that's been recent. There's evidence that insulin and IGF receptors are present in acute leukemia cells, chronic leukemia cells, and there may be the potential to impact on the speed with which those cells will proliferate if we can make changes in ambient levels of insulin in populations. That's just a theory, but it's a more exciting and certainly biologically more plausible one that can explain the relationship between, for instance, how exercise may reduce recurrence rate. So I think we have this new horizon around us that is interesting, that these interventions can actually change survival. We can't promise it. One of the most interesting things I think that is part of this, much of translational research, is identifying biomarkers that are predictors of this response. Well, intriguingly, there is work in basic science that insulin and IGF signaling will reduce, by reducing those levels, it will reduce growth of tumor cell populations. David Sabatini and others at Harvard have shown this. And one of the things he's discovered, that if you actually have constitutive activation of PI3K/A KIT, these downstream activators, it eliminates the ability of these signaling changes to work. So we may be actually able to identify within studies people who will actually respond to exercise and lifestyle.
Can you talk about the whole insulin story? You know, you've mentioned this a couple times, just for, right, the, for the audience, you know, like, what is insulin, how is that important, and how do we modulate that in the more favorable direction?
Absolutely. Well, what's interesting is insulin is a hormone that, for most people, they consider it important for modulating and controlling blood sugar. And for many years, this was, of course, recognized as a factor involved in diabetes. And there are two types of diabetes. There's diabetes type 1, which is actually a condition often either autoimmune or virally mediated, frequently starts in childhood, in which there is a loss of the ability of the pancreas to make insulin. More frequently and much more, unfortunately, more common with the weight gain in the population is what's called type 2 or non-insulin-dependent diabetes, in which people, as they put on weight, particularly in certain types of weight gain, what we call visceral obesity, it engenders the loss of the sensitivity to insulin. So in order to control blood sugar levels, the body has to continually generate more and more insulin. So people with this condition called non-insulin-dependent diabetes or type 2 diabetes have higher levels of insulin long-term. And for many people, prior to the development of diabetes, there is a pre-diabetic state, which we now call the metabolic syndrome. Now, this, unfortunately, is incredibly common. Up to 40% of adults over 40 to 50 have this. And as we look back now, retrospectively, we're seeing a very broad effect of this condition. Gerald Reeven, who described this, he called this Syndrome X. And we knew that this was a potential precursor for diabetes and actually was linked to the incidence of cardiovascular disease, stroke, and other vascular events. And he actually showed in a study of adults in the San Francisco area, he's out at Stanford, that people who had this condition had a surprisingly much higher incidence of cancer as well. That's led to more and more research studies showing that people with this pre-diabetic state have risks of cancer that are far greater.
Barry, tell us what the metabolic syndrome is.
The metabolic syndrome, as I mentioned, is a pre-diabetic state, and we define that as people who have, and there are five criteria for that, that we don't actually measure the insulin as part of that, but it's people who have high lipids, but particularly have high triglycerides, whose cholesterol may or may not be elevated, but they have a disproportionately low HDL. They also have a disproportionately high glucose level, above 110 fasting. And they also may have hypertension. And they're heavier. Their body, you know, we use a thing called body mass index, but simply stated, we look at the waist size. So for a woman, a waist over 35, interestingly, most women don't know it. You have to measure it. They know their dress size, but they've never known their waist size. And for men, waist over 40. And those are the five criteria for this. And when what's interesting, if you look at cancer mortality, it's clearly higher in people with a metabolic syndrome. And the more of those five criteria you have, the greater your cancer mortality will be. And the question has always been, well, you know, is it sugar? We all know that sugar is necessary and is disproportionately used by tumors. But insulin itself, in addition to improving glucose uptake in cells, directly stimulates cell proliferation. And of course, in adulthood, the way to speed up the rapidity with which a tumor will develop and evolve is to enhance cell proliferation. So in many ways, our goal, how do we shrink down the levels of these growth factors? And we know through lifestyle studies in preventing breast cancer, by exercise and even modest weight loss, you can lower insulin enough to potentially affect outcomes. And there's one study in breast cancer that's actually shown that. It's an intriguing idea. You know, we think about how tamoxifen reduces breast cancer by simply blocking estrogen. Well, the idea is we might be able to do the same thing by suppressing insulin. It may have the same impact on reducing tumor cell growth, but in far more cancers. That's what's the most exciting part of this. And that's where I think the future of cancer nutrition is looking at, the role of this metabolic syndrome, the metabolic status of people in affecting long-term survival.
We're going to take a short break for a medical minute. Please stay tuned to learn more information about nutrition and cancer with Dr. Barry Boyd.
It's estimated that nearly 200,000 men in the U.S. will be diagnosed with prostate cancer this year, and over 2,000 new cases will be diagnosed in Connecticut alone. 1 in 6 American men will develop prostate cancer in the course of his lifetime. Major advances in the detection and treatment of prostate cancer have dramatically decreased the number of men who die from this disease. Screening for prostate cancer can be performed quickly and easily in a physician's office using 2 simple tests, a physical exam and a blood test. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers like the one at Yale to test innovative new treatments for prostate cancer. The Da Vinci robotic surgical system is an option available for patients at Yale that uses 3-dimensional imaging to enable the surgeon to perform a prostatectomy without the need for a large incision. This has been a Medical Minute, and more information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Lynn Wilson, and I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Francine Foss. Today we're joined by Dr. Barry Boyd, and we're discussing nutrition and cancer. Barry, tell us about some of the methods that you incorporate into your practice to help patients live a healthier lifestyle, or at least try to do that, and what are some of the challenges that you face in trying to do so?
Sure. Thanks, Lynn. Well, first, one of the things I do is I do a central assessment. As a medical oncologist, of course, I do a detailed history. And then I, in addition to the standard history, I really go into detail about dietary history and family history of things like diabetes. One of the things I've discovered is that, you know, we tend to be one system focused, so you think about the cancer, but I really broadly look at cardiovascular risk, endocrine history. Do they have a history of vascular disease, or is there a family history? Do they have gestational diabetes? Gestational diabetes is a predictor of developing diabetes later in life, and a clue that they may have insulin resistance. And then I use basic laboratory evaluations, including measures of insulin resistance. So I'll do fasting lipids. You know, many oncologists won't do that, but I've recognized more and more that if you know a person's metabolic status, if they turned out to be predictably endocrine hormone resistant or insulin resistant, there's a whole different focus. And we tend to think of that as being weight related. And a perfect example is a woman who came to me last week who had HER2 positive breast cancer, metastatic. She had not been treated. She had been going through non-conventional therapies. And she came to me recognizing she needs to be more aggressive. And because her disease was progressing, she needed to simply come back into the system. And I spent a lot of time encouraging people to understand the value of conventional medicine rather than making them fearful. And I did a simple workup. She was a phys ed teacher who had been physically active, healthy, had normal lipids in the past. She was now sick for a year. And I did a metabolic profile. Her triglycerides were over 200. Her glucose was elevated. Her HDL was very low. And I said, you know, unpredictably with very low weight, despite having weight loss, she had the metabolic syndrome now. And so it's a clue that not only do people who are healthy have this and may be at risk, but once you have cancer, you may develop it in the setting of an unhealthy life because you're less active, your diet has changed, you may lose weight, but your weight is now more lipid, more water weight, and you lose lean body mass. And so we need all to be aware that even within this thinner population, there's a thing called metabolically obese normal weight. So for this woman, I had this metabolic profile. I was able to tailor a dietary approach, work with our nutritionist, and encourage her to exercise. And one more fascinating part of the story, which is this new information that metformin, if appropriate medically, seems to be able to target the high levels of insulin. And it is a medicine that I sometimes use, if appropriate medically, because there's enormous amount of information that's growing that metformin has a potential secondary effect in terms of tumor progression. Clearly, patients with diabetes on metformin have lower cancer risk. There's a lot of information that metformin has a targeted effect on tumor stem cells, which is really fascinating. And so, last study, not yet published from Harvard, that metformin, because it lowers insulin, may actually be able to reduce the doses of chemo that have an effective anti-stem cell effect. So it's part of the insulin story, but it's really what I see as a light into the role of pharmacologic approaches as well as lifestyle in targeting the metabolic syndrome and potentially substantially changing the natural history of some diseases. It remains to be seen in research, but I think it's where we're going in terms of nutrition.
Can you comment on other nutritional issues that you see in cancer patients? Are there specific dietary recommendations that you make in general to cancer patients?
Yeah, Francine, I do. One of the things is that, you know, there is this fear about foods. One of the most interesting things is people come to me with dietary myths. So you hear, for instance, you know, I must drink green tea, I must not have coffee. And I don't know how many people know that. But intriguingly, you know, I've done a lot of research into the epidemiology of coffee. And it turns out in many studies that coffee is actually linked to a substantial reduction in some cancers, reduction in cirrhosis, because what coffee is in the Norwegian population, which have a disproportionate amount of coffee in their diet, 65% of the total antioxidant constituents of their diet comes from coffee.
Can you tell us the same thing is true for chocolate?
The dilemma between chocolate and coffee is yes, in modest amounts. And actually, there is a reference that I use all the time from David Jacobs, who is a public health specialist at University of Minnesota. And working with people in Norway, he actually has cataloged, based on laboratory studies, the relative antioxidant power of different components of food. And if you look at the highest antioxidants within food, what I found is, for instance, what's in there is Cocoa Krispies and, you know, because of the chocolate. In fact, there's more antioxidants per gram in Cocoa Krispies than there is in broccoli. Most interestingly, and this is an example why mythology is important, a patient comes to me with breast cancer receiving radiation. The physician and the radiation therapy technologist at the adjoining hospital told her, stop the green tea, it'll interfere with the radiation. It turns out green tea is not a very potent antioxidant and is very unlikely to have any effect on her radiation therapy. But simultaneously, she admits to me that she's taking 8 capsules of ground cloves per day. Now, what is interesting is in that list of antioxidants, ground cloves is 2 orders of magnitude more potent as an antioxidant than any other food. And I said, if there's anything you should not take during radiation, it's ground clove. And she had no clue, and nobody in the radiation field was aware of this. That is a pharmacologic dose like taking 1,000 units of vitamin E. And we all know now that we have to be concerned about antioxidants during radiation, particularly where radiation's impact is largely, the oxidative radical formation that damages membranes and cells. So you don't want to be on high antioxidants. But that's an example. If you don't know about nutrition, you may neglect something that potentially could interfere with therapy.
Could you talk about all these supplements that people are taking? You know, my patients come in with long lists of things and ask whether they should or shouldn't be taking them. And I think they're also taking things that I don't even know about. can you comment on just the role of supplements in general and herbal therapies?
Yeah. One of the areas, this is a gigantic field, as you know. And the problem with supplements is, in large part, it's unregulated. Patients are desperate. You know, this is a field where, as we know, many people have diseases that we may not have a cure for, and so they will seek out answers. And this is a field fraught with problems for patients. I have individuals in my practice who will spend $2,000 or $3,000 a month. I've had patients who will mortgage their house, and they're afraid to stop the supplements. As I said to one patient, she was taking 135 capsules a day, 35 with breakfast.
Wow.
She was spending $3,000 a month. And the only thing that might have a positive effect was she was overweight and losing weight because of this. It was a calorie-restricted effect of all of these supplements, making her sick. But clearly, and the people recommending it were in the field, and they had created a a combination of nutrients, each of which you could find a research study suggesting this might affect a portion of a pathway. Now, you'd be intrigued. There'd be in cancer research, clinical cancer research, other journals within the American Association for Cancer Research that suggested some benefit. Then you put together 100 nutrients or more, and you have no clue their pharmacology, how they interact. And a very simple thing I tell patients, there is intriguing data that a component of tea, ECGC, has an anti-proliferative effect on chronic lymphocytic leukemia cells. There is another study showing that turmeric or curcumin has the same effect. And when given together in a sequential fashion, there's interesting data that it can suppress the progression of those cells. But if you put the two together, they actually antagonize one another. And that's a simple example where people don't realize that if you use many nutrients, all of the pharmacologic side effects are totally unpredictable.
What do you tell people about Chinese herbal medicine if people are going to herbalists?
One example, Chinese herbal medicine, you know, number one, you need to know your Chinese herbalist. If you're on chemotherapy, I'm very, very anxious about that. I'm particularly anxious about one setting where we use chemotherapy, and that is in the adjuvant setting. Let's say I have a patient with breast cancer or a patient with Hodgkin's or non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and you have a curative setting. If you don't have, for instance, in breast cancer, anything to measure, so you don't know is the tumor, you're now treating a patient to prevent recurrence and there's no measurable cancer cells, there's no marker, you have virtually no way of knowing if you're going to interfere with that disease. Ethically, to do anything to affect the value of your adjuvant therapy would be dangerous. And many people come to me and I say, under no circumstance ethically could I recommend using anything that could impact on that. I have people with end-stage disease who want to take a nutrient. I say, look, I have a tumor that I can measure. I have markers that I can measure. I will be watching over you. If you choose to do this, recommend we have no idea, but at least I can monitor you. And then I look at the nutrients. I say, what are the potential adverse effects? What are the pharmacologic consequences? Does it alter coumadin? Does it alter coagulation status? Does it have impacts on medications? Does it have any other potential adverse effects? An example of this is high folic acid. Folic acid is a proliferative stimulus in populations. And so it turns out that there's interesting data that too much folic acid may actually enhance the speed with which tumors grow or increase the risk of developing malignancy in at-risk populations. And many people are not aware of that. B12, the same thing. B12 and folate are very involved in what's called DNA precursor synthesis. And there's intriguing work now that you can actually label B12 and use it as an imaging technique to look for tumors. I call it the BET scan.
Interesting.
So, and yet there are people who have no idea what they're taking. I have people coming to me with bottles of supplements, and I ask them, do you know how much B12 is in this? And they have no idea. I ask them, how much medication do you take and what's your dose? They all know their doses. So people have this gigantic experiment now. I mean, in phase one trials, 80% of patients are taking supplements. And my concern is many of our phase one trials may be confounded by unrecognized and unmeasured supplement use that could impact on the effect of these medications. So we really need as physicians to be very cautious and careful about asking the questions what they're taking. And my goal is to try to educate them about the potential risks for that.
Dr. Barry Boyd is director of the Integrative Medicine Program at Greenwich Hospital and an assistant clinical professor at the Yale School of Medicine. If you have questions or would like to share your comments, visit yalecancercenter.org, where you can also get the podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.